Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann Fisher this morning. Bob Green has been writing for four decades for the Chicago Tribune, Esquire magazine, Life magazine. He's authored several books, including the bestseller Hang Time, Days and Dreams with Michael Jordan, and also When We Get to Surf City. But Bob got his first professional newspaper gig working as a copy boy for the Columbus Citizen Journal, just a short ride from his home in Bexley. This hour we'll look back at those days, as Bob has done in his latest book, Late Edition, which is now out in paperback. Bob, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks so much, Mike. Glad to be talking with you again.
Your first story for the CJ was never published. You wrote about your classmates' reaction to the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Tell us about that.
To this day, I don't know how that all happened, but it's the luckiest thing what ended up happening that ever happened to me. It was November 22nd, 1963, and we were in Mrs. Sarah Amos's sixth period English class at Bexley High School, and there was this sound on the loudspeaker. It was like a crackling, like a radio sound, like someone twisting through the dials. And, you know, the first thing we heard was someone saying, "This is your country music station," and then switched to another station. And we started laughing in the class because the only person with the access to the PA system was C.W. Jones, the principal. Mm-hmm. But all of a sudden it stopped on one station, and we heard the word say, "Was taken to Parkland Hospital." And then a few minutes later, the voice said that the president was dead. And some students in the class started crying. Some put their heads down on the desk. Some looked at each other, just not knowing what to do. There was this little glassed-in area in the back of the room, and I walked back there, and I looked out at the class. There was a typewriter back there, and I started writing a story about what I was seeing. The lead sentence was, "The class sits in stunned silence." And I wrote about 500 words, and the bell rang, and we went down to Mr. Millard's history class, and I said to him, "I have to go down to the Citizen Journal." And it was such an odd day that he didn't question it. Mm-hmm. And I motioned to a friend of mine, and I said, "I need a ride downtown." And we drove down Broad Street and went on to 3rd Street. I walked into the dispatch building, and at the time, the Citizen Journal was the morning paper. It was on the mezzanine. I took the elevator up there. I walked in the room, and you can imagine the president had just been murdered.
Chaos.
Yeah. And I walked up to a man who seemed to be in charge, and I said, "I'm Bob Green. I go to Bexley High School. I wrote a story." And he looked up, and he said, "We're kind of busy. The president has just been shot."
Yeah.
And I said, "I know. That's what the story's about." And I handed it to him, and he said, "Thanks. You got to let us go get our paper out." And I went back home, and I picked up the Citizen Journal the next morning. It was Saturday, and no story. I tried to call, but there was no one there because the CJ didn't have a Sunday paper.
Mm-hmm.
On Monday, Sunday I called back. They said, "We're busy. Lee Harvey Oswald has just been shot by Jack Ruby."
Mm-hmm.
On Monday, I called again, and the city editor said, I said, "Are you going to run my story?" And the city editor, whose name was Bill Moore, said, "Well, your story was about the president being shot. That was on Friday. It's Monday. I think it's outdated." And I said to him, "Well, that's why I think it should have run on Saturday." I was 16 years old.
What made you think that they would publish your story?
I don't know. I don't know how I got down there. I don't know why I did it, how I picked the Citizen Journal. But I was in love. Mm-hmm. I mean, the subtitle of Late Edition is a love story. Mm-hmm. I fell in love. I mean, the noise, the laughter. I mean, there wasn't laughter that day, but yeah. I would hear it years to come. The typewriters clattering, the people shouting. It just is where I wanted to be. And that summer, when a copy boy position opened up unexpectedly, I got a call from the same city editor who didn't run my story. And he said, "Was I available to come down there and work?" And it's the luckiest thing that ever happened to me, walking in those mezzanine doors at 34 South 3rd Street.
292-8513 to join our discussion. We're speaking with writer Bob Green, Bexley native. Got his start at the Columbus Citizen Journal. If you have any fond memories of the CJ, we'll also talk about downtown Columbus in the mid to late 60s as Bob got his start in the newspaper business. His book describes a lot about the hustle and bustle of downtown Columbus and what was going on during that time as well. 292-8513, we welcome your memories of the CJ, getting it on your doorstep every morning, and you can email those as well to allsides@wosu.com. Bob Green at Fishermen.org. Bill Moore, did you ever ask him, even, you know, years later, why he didn't run your story? Did he even remember you bringing that copy to him after that?
You know, one of the nicest things that ever happened to me, I think it was one of my books, I'm not sure whether it was Hang Time or All Summer Long, but I was doing a signing in Columbus at the Little Professor Bookstore up on Lane Avenue. Maybe it's not. But there was a line to get books signed, and a guy came up to me, and it was Bill Moore, the guy who gave me my first job. And of course, it was odd for him. Why is this kid showing up in the CJ newsroom on the busiest news day since World War II? But I think one, the paper was a little tight that day. There was a lot of news breaking. But two, I think he thought, well, you know, I must really want it. Mm-hmm. You know, I must really want to work for a newspaper to come downtown and walk in there. It's of all the places I've ever been, no place ever felt as much like home to me as that now empty of news space on the mezzanine at 34 South 3rd Street. It seemed like the center of the world. You mentioned downtown Columbus, Mike. You could look out the glass windows from the back of the sports department, and you could see the State House. You could see over toward Broad and High. And back then, downtown Columbus was not just the center of the city, but if anything important happened, that's where it was going to happen. I mean, mm-hmm. There was no Easton. Yeah. There was no Polaris. You know, if you wanted to shop, you went downtown to Lazarus. If you wanted to get lunch, you'd go over to Paoletti's or the Neal House. I mean, downtown felt like the center of the world, especially when you were a young guy just trying to get started. And every day, walking into that front door of the Dispatch, you know, on top of the building, there were, and I think there still are, those red old English letters saying the Columbus Dispatch, mm-hmm. Ohio's greatest home newspaper. Well, if the Dispatch was Ohio's greatest newspaper, we at the Citizen Journal, by default, certainly weren't. But it sure was fun in there. Mm-hmm. And as I said earlier, the sound I remember the most fondly is just the sound of all that laughter of a bunch of imperfect people putting together an imperfect product for an imperfect world, and we got to go downtown and do it again every day.
Now, your first job was a copy boy, and that basically you're the gopher.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned Paoletti's to you a second ago. I mean, four or five times a day I would go over to Paoletti's and get – you know, coffee, sandwiches, fried egg, and, you know, sandwiches now. You think the CDC would put warnings on. People would get, you know, fried egg, bacon, and ham sandwiches for the whole staff four or five times a day. But for a kid who was a little bit shy, it was a good thing because that way I got to go around and talk to every member of the Citizen Journal staff numerous times every day. I would have never had the nerve to go up and introduce myself and say, I'm Bob Green, the new copy boy. But because I was going to get food for them, they were happy to see me, not because I was me, but because I was going to bring them something to eat or drink. And so I got to know them all.
Mm-hmm. 292-8513. We're speaking with Bob Green. His latest book is a late edition, a love story, talking about his days at the Columbus Citizen Journal, now out in paperback. Your first story was about a golf ball.
You know, I will never forget it. I was one of the things, Mike, that you mentioned, I did the sort of grunt work, and one of the things you did was called the emergency runs. Back then, the papers ran every day in agate type, a little type. Every time the fire trucks went out, every time the emergency squads went out, and you would call multiple times each shift the local fire and police departments, and they would usually say something like treated and they'd give you a name, treated and released, mm-hmm. dead on arrival. One day I called up, and the dispatcher said to me, "Well, we had a golf ball blow up," and I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said a man had been trying to cut open the center of a liquid center golf ball because he'd always been curious about what was in a liquid center golf ball. Well, bad idea. The goo inside, you know, shot out and got into his eye,
yeah.
And he had to go to the hospital. Well, I'm thinking, okay, if I put this in the emergency runs in this little one-line small type, no one's going to see it. And if I tell the city editor about it, he'll probably assign a reporter. That's no good. I want to write this.
Yeah.
So I called the guy's wife up. His name was Samuel Self Jr. And I interviewed her, and she said he was okay now, but he had indeed gone down in the basement with a saw and tried to open up this golf ball and explode in his eye. And I wrote up three paragraphs, and I took it over to the assistant city editor, because Bill Moore was off that day, to Bill Cassie, the assistant city editor, and I handed it to him. And I stood there just waiting, and I was so nervous. And he was smiling, and he said, "This is good." And I'll never forget it because, I mean, he could have said, "What are you doing writing a story? That's not your job." Or he could have said, "This is garbage." But he smiled and he said, "This is good." And I saw him crunch it down into two paragraphs. And he sent it over to the copy desk. And I stood behind the copy editor who was working on it. His name was Charlie Stein. And I just stood there and watched it. And this guy, you know, this guy probably processed 100 pieces of copy a day. He didn't care about this two-paragraph brief, but it meant the world to me.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw him write. You know, there were no computers then. You wrote the headlines on top of the copy. And I saw him write the headline, "Two Banks, Golf Ball Fights Back." And my job was to put it up in the pneumatic tube that sent it up to the linotype operators. So I sent my story up there. And that dinner hour that night, I went up there, and there was a galley sheet of all the stories that were ready to go on the paper. And there it was, "Golf Ball Fights Back," two paragraphs, in actual Citizen Journal type. And I stood there the entire dinner hour and just, like, almost stood sentry over my story. And I rode the bus home that night, and the next morning I was up, like, at 6 o'clock. I heard the paper hit the front stoop. And I ran out, you know, opened the front door, and there was the Citizen Journal rolled up with a rubber band around it. And I opened it up, and I read through the whole paper, and I didn't see it. And I was just so disappointed. But then I went through it again, and there on the bottom of the obit page, two paragraphs, "Golf Ball Fights Back." And it was by me, and there was no name on it, yeah. Of course, but I'd written something, and it was in an actual newspaper. I mean, it's not like today where you can write a blog and publish yourself in a second. A newspaper, if you wanted someone to read your words, someone had to publish them. And I still have this. And actually, I was in Columbus, as you know, in June to make a speech at the Metropolitan Club to honor my mother. And I invited Bill Cassie, the assistant city editor, to come to the speech because literally, Bill changed my life that day. You know, had Bill said to me, "Your job's not to write stories," I probably wouldn't have had the nerve to try it again. But he said, "This is good," and it got in the Citizen Journal. And I know it's probably hard for people today to realize what a big deal it was then to have a story written by you in a newspaper, but it was a big deal.
And I'm looking at the back cover of the jacket of your book, and there it is. And it looks like it's got some Scotch tape glue.
I had that thing taped in a scrapbook for years, and I carefully took it out of the scrapbook because on the hardcover edition of Late Edition, I don't think it's on the paperback, but on the hardcover, yeah, that's not an artist's conception of what the story was. That's the Golf Ball Fights Back story right there.
There it is. 292-8513. We're speaking with Bob Green, the best-selling author, Bexley native, who got his start at the Citizen Journal. We'll reminisce more about the glory days, of the Citizen Journal, and also take a look at downtown Columbus and what that was like back in those days. That's when All Sides continues on WOSU.
Support for WOSU comes from the Sherrington Group Financial Planners and Investment Consultants, providing timely guidance, education, and options to complex issues affecting clients' futures.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News, Wednesday night at 8 on WOSU TV. Learn new ways to start the day with the breakfast special. Rick Seaback visits interesting and unusual breakfast spots around the country, including two restaurants in our own backyard. Local eateries Skillet in German Village and The Best in Westerville are featured in this national search to see what's cooking for breakfast. See why there's more to breakfast than a bowl of cold cereal. Wednesday night at 8 on WOSU TV.
This is Terry Gross, and I have about 15 seconds to explain why you should listen to Fresh Air. You should listen because, unlike this little promo, on Fresh Air we have time. Time to spend with incredibly interesting people in the arts, entertainment, and politics. Enough time that we get to know them. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air will be here at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 74 degrees currently in downtown Columbus at 11:20 this morning. Showers and thunderstorms today, a high of 83. Partly cloudy tonight with a chance of rain as well, a low of 65. Clouds for Tuesday with a chance of rain and a high of 85. All Sides with Ann Fisher with guest host Mike Thompson continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Our guest, Bob Green. You know him for the books he's written. He's partnered with Michael Jordan on a book. He's written several books and wrote for the Chicago Tribune and Esquire magazine and Life magazine. He's been on CNN and ABC. But his latest book talks about his days at the Citizen Journal, where he got his start. And he talks about what the newsroom was like back in those days. Bob, one of the things I enjoyed about this book is my first radio job was with a radio station that at the time was owned by a newspaper. And this was back in the mid-'80s. And the newspaper newsrooms were still using typewriters back then, so I could remember walking through that newsroom and hearing many of the same things that you describe in the book. And newsrooms are never quiet places, but they were even louder places back then because of all the things that were going on with typewriters and people running around in vacuum tubes. Describe what that newsroom was like back then.
Well, it was like it wasn't like grown-ups worked there. I guess that's what I liked about it. I mean, I envisioned business offices being quiet and people talking in hushed tones and going into private offices. The mezzanine at 34 South 3rd Street, where the Citizen Journal was just full of noise all the time. The typewriters banging, people shouting across the room to each other, and ringing phones. Mm-hmm. One summer, I worked at the sports department, and answering the phones at the CJ sports department was the most fun and you could have, because even the words you used to answer the phone would ring, we'd pick it up and go, sports. And it was a small department. There were, you know, Kay Kessler, Tom Pastorius, Tom Keyes, George Strode, all young at that point. And the phone would ring, and we'd sometimes three or four of us would pick it up at the same moment. Sports, it was like, you know, singing in harmony. So I like saying it anyway. But one night, the phone rang, and I picked it up, and I said, sports. And the voice on the other end said, now, that's no way to answer a telephone, is it? When you answer a telephone, you're supposed to say who you are first. And I said, yes, sir. He said, to whom am I speaking? And I thought I recognized the guy's voice, but he said, to whom am I speaking? And I said, it's Bob Green. He said, now your byline, I was like 20 years old. He said, your byline is Bob Green Jr., correct? I've seen it. I said, yes. He said, are your parents Robert and Phyllis Green from Bexley? I said, yes, they are. He said, now I know your parents. I've met them. They're fine people. I know they didn't raise you to answer a telephone that way. I know they want you to answer a telephone politely. I said, yes, sir. And he said, so you really don't want your parents to think you answered your telephone in such a sloppy way, do you? I said, no, sir. He said, fine. Now, this is Woody Hayes. Could I please speak to Tom Pastorius? And with my hand sort of shaken, I gave the phone to Tom Pastorius. It was indeed Woody Hayes calling in, and he thought he was – I mean, Woody, you have to remember, was it just a totally different era. Woody, obviously, was the most famous man in Ohio, mm-hmm. and yet Woody Hayes always had a listed telephone number. If you opened up the white pages of the Columbus phone book, there was a W.W. Hayes on Cardiff Road. He thought that if you were a member of the community, you had to be a member of the community, and that if he was going to represent Columbus, he had to be as accessible as anybody else. And so Woody Hayes, and it made for a lot of phone calls from a bunch of drunks in the middle of the night.
Even but, back then?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, Woody would get these phone calls from mm-hmm. people, and yet he thought, and when he said to me, that's no way for you to answer a telephone. Your parents didn't tell you to answer a telephone that way, did they? Mm-hmm. He thought he was doing me a favor. And you know something? He probably was.
How did you answer the phone from then on?
Sports. I couldn't help it.
You didn't say sports, this is Green or something like that.
No, and Woody, and I was hoping it wasn't Woody on the other end, because make the same mistake twice.
Uh-huh. 292-8513, we're speaking with Bob Green. His latest book is Late Edition, a love story talking about his days at the Citizen Journal. Bob, you talk about the characters in that newsroom. Al, I hope I pronounce these, Gal Getchell, the cartoonist. You mentioned Tom Pastorius and George Strode. These were, I mean, this is back in newspapers' heydays. These are the folks that everybody read every morning. and really looked at as celebrities in town.
Yeah, you know, and I feel like I sort of got in at the tail end of the great era. I mean, the 1964 when I became a copy boy, you know, that was the year of the Beatles. That was the year of the Rolling Stones. Television was taking over. Newspapers were starting to fade. And yet newspapers still had one foot back in the 1930s. In 1964, Walter Winchell was still writing his gossip column in New York. Mm-hmm. So the tradition was from the old. We were stepping. And the one thing we never would have guessed for a second was that there was an end date on this, that someday the Citizen Journal would be gone, that all that you talked about downtown, Mike, mm-hmm. Paoletti's would be gone, the Lazarus Department Store would be gone, all the landmarks that seemed like they would last forever, the ones that we were covering, they didn't seem to be fading, and yet if we'd thought about it a little bit more, I think we could have sensed the first glimmers of it. You talk about the characters. The day that Sam Shepard, the most famous at the time convicted murderer in America, was released from the Ohio Penitentiary, a young lawyer named F. Lee Bailey got him sprung, and it was a huge story. And all the Citizen Journal reporters and photographers were fanning out all over downtown into the governor's office, into the prison itself, trying to get the story. And a phone call came in with a tip. They said that Sam Shepard was drinking at Benny Klein's Bar and Steakhouse, which is right downtown. And the rumor was that he was with his blonde girlfriend, who was supposed to be a blonde glamour girl. I'm using the newspaper phrases of the time.
Yeah.
Who was, I think she was supposed to be the sister-in-law of Dr. Joseph Goebbels of the Third Reich, you know, Hitler's henchman. I mean, anything seemed possible in those days. And the city editor looked around, and there were no reporters and photographers available. And he said to me, go over to Benny Klein's and see if Sam Shepard is there drinking with the sister-in-law of the Third Reich. You know, I mean, I was 17. I didn't think I could get into Benny Klein's bar.
Yeah.
But I walked over there, and I walked in, and there was no one there. But the city editor told me, if Dr. Sam Shepard, and for those few people who are listening who don't remember, he was the character who
the fugitive was based on.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he was the most famous prisoner in America. Now all of a sudden he was out. The city editor said to me, if Sam Shepard is drinking at Benny Klein's, ask him if he would mind walking you back to the Citizen Journal because we'd like to get a picture of him in our photo studio. Tell him it'll just take a few minutes. So here I am being told, you know, go to this famous downtown Columbus bar, get the most famous convicted murderer in America, and say to him, I know you've only been out of prison for 20 minutes. Would you mind walking back to the Citizen Journal with me? They'd like to take the picture in the photo studio.
And it turns out he wasn't there.
No, he wasn't there. But, I mean, and then I met up with my friends later that night. I mean, there was a place out on the 3C Highway called Bounce Land where I think for 50 cents they had these slabs of rubber pulled tautly against these open pits, and you could bounce up and down for like 15 minutes for 50 cents. And I think that night we went out to Bounce Land, and I'm sitting there, you know, bouncing up and down on the 3C Highway, and I'm thinking, you know, a couple hours ago I was trying to find the most famous convicted murderer in America and take him back to the Citizen Journal. What a great way to spend the summer.
Mm-hmm. 292-8513. If you have memories of Bounce Land or downtown Columbus or the Citizen Journal, we'd like to hear from you. We're speaking with Bob Green. His latest book is Late Edition, a love story talking about those days with the Citizen Journal and the newspaper business in those days. You talk about what it took to get a story on the air. Now in these days of cell phones and emails and, you know, all this electronic, all these electronic devices that we really rely on, you would take dictation from a sports reporter covering a golf tournament.
Absolutely. I mean, actually, for those of your listeners who read Late Edition, you'll see that the whole story is framed. I was covering the 2008 presidential campaign, the Barack Obama John McCain campaign. I was traveling on this bus it looked like a bus from the outside, called the CNN Election Express. And it was basically a broadcast studio on wheels. I mean, you walked into it. It was, you could transmit live pictures from it. You could edit video. You could write your columns, which I was doing, and upload them while the bus was still rolling. It was just this electronic marvel. And we pulled into Columbus, and that's how Late Edition begins. I looked out the window, and there's that building at 34 South 3rd Street. where we used to do it a very different way. And that's exactly how it worked. If a reporter was on the road, and most of our reporters didn't go on the road. We didn't have much of a budget.
Mm-hmm.
But the sports writers, you know, if Ohio State football or basketball was playing out of town, those sports writers are going to travel because no one was going to buy a Columbus newspaper if they didn't cover the Buckeyes. And the other exception was if Jack Nicklaus was playing in a major tournament somewhere in the world, Kay Kessler, the great sports writer of the Citizen Journal, was going to be sent to cover it because you had to cover Jack. So Kay would be on the road at the United States Open or the PGA or the Masters, and he would call in, and he would be at his typewriter at some golf course somewhere in the world, and me, being the kid, would be assigned to take his dictation, and you would sort of put the receiver of the phone, you know, between your shoulder and your ear, and he would pace his dictation to the sound of your typewriter keys, which he could hear over the line. So he would say, you know, Jack Nicklaus shot a 2 under par 70 today, and he would wait as I typed it. And then he would say, to take the lead in the United States Open at Baltusrol Golf Course, period, paragraph. And he would wait till he hear me hit the return shift and start the next paragraph. And it felt, you know, as you said, Mike, now it is just done seamlessly.
On laptop, you
know,
and
you hit the button and the whole world is reading it. There's no one in between.
Yeah.
And yet the teamwork inherent in hearing this sports writer who I admired somewhere in the country saying the words he had just typed to me over a long distance line, me typing them, as soon as I finished sending him up the tube where a union linotype operator would set up and type, and the next morning the truck drivers would take him out, and it was a miracle. It was on your front step. The same words that Kay Kessler was writing, you know, I would wake up the next morning and I'd think, I heard him say those words to me over the phone.
Yeah, you played a role in that story when you read it the next day.
Yeah.
You mentioned the barriers to entry back when you tried to get your first story published, and when you published the exploding golf ball story, you mentioned that you couldn't tell that story to the masses unless somebody who owned a printing press allowed you to do it. And now with Facebook and Twitter and blogs and the internet, anybody can do this.
And I just wonder whether the same value is put into it. I mean, when we were talking at the beginning of our conversation today, I said to you, believe me, it's a big deal to have a story in the paper back then. I don't know if it seems like a big deal when there is no barrier to entry, when you can just do it. Obviously, the democratization of it is marvelous. It's a great free speech, freedom of the press, anything can go. And yet, you sort of felt like by making it into the paper, even for a little two-paragraph story, you'd made it past a hurdle.
Mm-hmm.
You had maneuvered around an obstacle. And I would, every morning, the Citizen Journal, I think at that point, cost 7 cents. If I had a story in the paper, I would go out the next morning before I went to work, go over to Main Street, either to a news box or to Rogers Drugstore in the community where I lived, and I would buy 5 papers. And I would, you know, take them home, and I would keep those 5 papers because how else was there going to be any proof that you'd ever written this? There was no, you know, digital storehouse on the internet. There was no internet. And so every day I would buy, if I had a story, I would buy those 5 papers. And I told Kay Kessler and Tom Pastorius about it one night in the sports desk, and they sort of laughed. And they said, you buy 5 papers? I said, yeah. I said, don't you keep your stories? They said, no. And I said, why? They said, well, we're just going to write another one tomorrow.
That's right.
But at one point, Kessler said to me, you know, there was probably a time when I did.
Mm-hmm.
But believe me, you'll get used to it. Except I never did. I was traveling this spring, and I was in Florida, and I had a piece on the op-ed page of the New York Times. And so I went out that morning to buy the Sunday New York Times. But then I realized if I wanted to keep 5 copies, it would cost me $30. So I didn't do it. But there's still something about having that piece of paper, and you wrote it.
Mm-hmm. Just a couple of minutes left. 292-8513. If you'd like to speak with Bob Green, talking about his days at the Citizen Journal and I guess you'd call it the final glory days of the newspaper industry with the Citizen Journal in downtown Columbus. You mentioned that, you know, a big thing that we're focusing on, and a lot of news organizations are focusing on now, as we try to figure out how to carve our niche and maintain our viability in this very fragmented media age, is hyperlocal. That's what we we go for it. Hyperlocal. But you write the Citizen Journal was doing hyperlocal back in the 1960s.
Absolutely. It was the Citizen Journal was basically a scrapbook of the town that we put together every day. I don't think there was any thought given to that. Now you also talk about navigation of newspapers to make it easier for the readers to navigate through it. There was no navigation.
Yeah, you put the golf ball stories in the
right.
orbit page.
You went out, you found the stories, and you put them in the paper, and you knew it was important. I mean, not important with a capital I. You know, it wasn't grandiose important. But if the people were not going to – if they didn't read it in the morning paper, in the Citizen Journal, and I guess we should back up now and point out that the Dispatch back then was the dominant paper still, but it was the evening paper.
Mm-hmm.
The Citizen Journal was the morning paper. And we figured if we didn't get the story, the people in the town wouldn't know about it the next day. And it was a scrapbook of the town, and I still – when I was back in Columbus for the speech at the Metropolitan Club in June – it was held at the athletic club downtown, and they part of the deal is they give you a room in the athletic club the night before. When I woke up early the morning of the speech, I got up, and it was a nice, warm Columbus day downtown. And I walked the same way I used to walk when I got off the Broad Street bus, and I walked down down that little alley and then down 3rd Street, and I walked into the lobby of the Dispatch building. And I looked up toward the mezzanine, which is now business offices up there. There's no newsroom there now. It's just the business functions of the Dispatch company. And it felt like going to work on all those summer days when I first started. You know, it felt like what a cool feeling that was. You walk in this room, and you're going to get on this elevator, and you're going to walk through those doors, and all of a sudden, the quietness of the outside world is going to disappear, and you're going to be in the middle of all that clatter.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know what's going to happen that day, but you know if it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon when you get to work, by 11 o'clock that night when you leave, these people in this room, this bunch, and I say this word advisedly, I think I say it, you know, with affection and flattery, this was a bunch of misfits, a bunch of people who would never have been able to find this kind of joy in any other kind of work. And I never felt I fit in more anywhere in my life than with this bunch of misfits. And by 11 o'clock that night, we were going to have made a newspaper.
Yeah.
And by the next day at this time, it not only will be read, but it'll be old.
Yeah, you'll start over.
And the thought every day when you woke up was, I get to go down again to the paper. I get to go down to the paper again today.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Joe, you're on the air. Go ahead, Joe. You're on the air with Bob Green on WOSU.
Thank you, Bob. And Bob, I appreciate all your work in the newspaper and in your authorship. The questions that I had, that number one is about veracity. We see so much of this email stuff that goes around. It's forwarded, and it's false. And then it goes around a second time, and somebody has to tell you it's false. I wonder about that being, whether that's ever going to get cleared up. And the second thing is when we see grammatical errors in reporting, and I wonder about the training of our newer reporters.
Let me answer the second thing first. I've noticed the same thing you have, which is even in the great American newspapers, you're seeing more grammatical errors and things that just, you know, a little bit sloppy. I don't think that's because of the training. I think what you're seeing is the inevitable result of all the cutbacks in newsrooms. There aren't enough people working there. The companies that own the newspapers, because of very real economic considerations, have laid people off and laid people off and laid people off. And if there's too few people processing the copy, if there's too much work on too tight a deadline, mistakes are going to get in. So my feeling is that some of these grammatical errors and misspellings even, or because there's just too few people who are being paid to do the work.
Not as many eyeballs checking that copy.
And on your first question, yeah, I mean, that's the problem with news on the Internet. You don't know where it comes from. I write a column now for CNN every Sunday at CNN.com, and I'm very impressed by the number of layers of people they have reading the stories before they go up. I mean, there's at least 4 sets of eyes on it, as far as I'm aware, before it goes up. And I think that's the key. If you've got enough people looking at the stories before they go in, but yeah, stuff on the Internet, the speed is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
The stuff that goes out on Twitter, you know, stuff that happened 30 seconds ago, But instead of just taking it with a grain of salt, you have to take it with a ton of salt because you don't know where it came from.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much, Bob Green, Bexley native, writer, best-selling author. His latest book is Late Edition, a love story talking about his days in the mid to late 60s working for the Citizen Journal. And it's a great read, especially if you grew up or worked downtown or grew up reading the Citizen Journal. It'll bring back a lot of memories. Bob, thanks for joining us on All Sides.
Mike, thanks so much for having me.
Take care. All Sides continues in a moment on WOSU NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Tonight at 10 on WOSU-TV, the first episode in a three-part series examining the life of George Shultz. The Turmoil and Triumph, the George Shultz Years, chronicles the career and contributions of former Secretary of State and the key shaper of foreign policy in President Ronald Reagan's administration. The series begins tonight at 10 on WOSU-TV. Currently 75 degrees in downtown Columbus, rain showers and thunderstorms throughout the day, and a high of 83 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight with a chance of showers and thunderstorms tonight and a low of 65. For Tuesday, mostly cloudy, also a chance of rain, maybe a thunderstorm in the afternoon, a high of 85. And looking ahead to Wednesday, partly sunny skies and a high of 90 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher with guest host Mike Thompson continues right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann this morning. It has been a tough spring and summer for peregrine falcons who nest in downtown Columbus. First, one of two young peregrine falcons that hatched on top of the Rhodes Tower died as it attempted its first flight. Then, a few days later, the mother died. At first, wildlife officials believed the falcon became distracted and flew into a window. But later, witnesses said a worker on the Leveque Tower struck it with a broom after the falcon dive-bombed him as he was trying to change filters on the tower's spotlights. As investigators look at the incident to see if any crime was committed, the story has generated a lot of chatter on the internet, with some highly critical of the worker for striking the bird and others defending the worker, saying he had the right to defend himself. So to try to make sense of this, we are joined by Donna Daniel. She is the Peregrine Nest Site Manager for the Ohio Division of Wildlife. She also writes the Falcon blog for the division. And welcome to All Sides, Donna.
Thanks, Greg. Glad to be here.
First, the investigation. What can you tell us about the progress, and did this worker do anything wrong?
Well, basically, I can't comment too much on the investigation other than to say that progress is being made, and we're hoping to wrap it up rather quickly. One thing I'd like to say to caution people that, you know, all of the information that's been released in the media so far has not been by our agency. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty much hearsay. And, you know, I would caution people also to keep an open mind and realize that there is always two sides to the story and to not be too quick to judge. And that's what our state wildlife officers and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agents are paid to do. They are professionals who will get to the bottom of this and sort it all out.
Okay. So the dispatch has reported what witness accounts say. And
exactly.
They've also reported that you're looking into it.
Right.
I know you can't get into details, but is there any big error that's out there that we want to get cleared up at this point?
I really, you know, can't comment other than, like I said, for everybody just to kind of step back and realize that, you know, the professionals need to do their jobs, and we will get, you know, all the stories out and all the facts out.
Okay. How common is it for a peregrine falcon, we assume is protecting her young, to dive bomb or to buzz a person below or nearby the nest?
Well, in Columbus, it's actually pretty common. I've talked to a number of building managers over the years who have called in with questions or concerns or comments. As biologists, we put ourselves in that position on purpose when we are maintaining the nest box or getting the young out of the nest for banding we put ourselves in that position where those birds are coming at us. So it can definitely be intimidating for people, but definitely, you know, welcome anybody that ever has any question, you know, to call us, and we'll let them know exactly what should be done.
I worked for a television station in Massachusetts, in Springfield, Massachusetts, and they had a peregrine falcon nest in one of the tall buildings downtown, and our weatherman, John Quill, if anyone's from there, he was on the air until he was in his 80s. He was doing a live shot from near the nest, and this falcon was dive bombing him between live shots through the entire afternoon, and finally it got him, and it scraped the top of his head. And John was an older man at the time, and he had a very bald head, and he proudly displayed to the viewers the scrape that the falcon had scraped on his head. That's exactly what happened there. The falcon was protecting her nest and was dive bombing what she perceived to be a threat.
Exactly, yeah. And peregrines are by nature very territorial, which is why we only have one nesting pair in downtown Columbus, because they are not going to tolerate another falcon in the area. And, you know, like I said, they will definitely aggressively defend mm-hmm. their territory. And, you know, there are steps that can be taken. And our goal is to have everybody safe, the workers downtown and the falcons also.
So there's one nesting falcon downtown per season?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I thought there were more. They've had 42 42 falcons have fledged downtown since this program began, 15, 20 years ago?
Exactly, over the years. Mm-hmm. But the way that peregrines are wired is basically the young, when they get grown up enough, they'll leave the area and not come back. Mm-hmm. So that's why in the off season we'll just, you know, at best have two falcons downtown, the male and the female.
Why have the nests in a downtown area?
That's an excellent question, because I've actually, since this has been in the news, I've gotten a lot of people that are concerned of why these birds are downtown. Why are they not in a more, quote, natural habitat? Actually, an urban area is a very natural habitat for a peregrine. Long before people even had the idea of putting out nest boxes in cities, these birds were nesting on buildings on their own accord. So it's amazing ability of a species to adapt. And as the landscape changed and skyscrapers were built, these birds looked at them as rock cliffs. And so the habitat is there.
So that's normally where they nest, is on a cliff, like in the Hocking Hills or someplace like that.
Yeah, actually higher cliff than you would see even in Hocking Hills.
I
so in other parts of the Midwest where they have, you know, quote, real cliffs, mm-hmm. That's where you're going to have the rural nesting peregrines. But the skyscrapers, bridges, smokestacks, things like that, that humans have made, mimic rock cliffs. And so these birds have simply exploited that habitat. And there's a good prey base downtown as well. You know, a lot of people think that they were brought in to eat pigeons. Mm-hmm. That is actually false. Peregrines were released in cities to help the population out. Do they eat pigeons? Sure, but they eat a lot of other birds as well.
Okay. 292-8513. Our phone number is 292-8513. If you'd like to speak with Donna Daniels, she is the Peregrine Nest Site Manager for the Ohio Division of Wildlife. She oversees the Peregrine Nest in downtown Columbus. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or join the conversation on our Facebook page as well. So if you didn't have the nest that you manage, mm-hmm. chances are the falcons would build their own nest in perhaps a site that you didn't – it was less – manageable or less conducive or less.
Exactly, right. The birds would be attracted to the structures of buildings anyway, and chances are they would lay their eggs in a place that was not safe for them. You know, maybe we've had in other places in the state birds try to nest in a gutter on a building, and then once you get a rainstorm, then the nest fails. So since the falcons are going to be in these habitats, what we've done as resource managers is install nesting boxes or nesting trays, and that way it helps to lure the falcons to a safe place that is safe for them in order to have a successful nest, and also safe for people too, mm-hmm. if there does happen to be a conflict. Because in other parts of the state, we've had them nest on actual high-rise residential buildings, you know, and if you pay a lot of money to have a nice high-rise apartment downtown and you can't go out on your balcony, mm-hmm. you know, people will get a little upset by that. So a lot of times the nesting box can be used to lure the bird away from a situation like that.
So if the accounts of this incident are true, and it has happened where these birds will instinctually protect their prey by dive bombing or buzzing people who walk by or anybody or anything that walks by. What should you do if you are doing washing a window in a downtown skyscraper, or you know, changing the lights, or installing a sign, or you know, if you're a firefighter or something like that, or in a downtown balcony of an apartment building?
Well, what I counsel people when they call, for sure, is to realize that these birds are generally going to go for the highest point, like the weatherman mm-hmm. story that you told. They're going to mm-hmm. go for the top of your head. Mm-hmm. So at the very least, have a hat, even a hard hat, on, which would be a safe thing to wear if somebody was out on a building anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you want to protect your head. And I also recommend that folks work in pairs. And for most of the building managers that I've talked to, the maintenance folks, they do work in pairs. So, you know, while one person is concentrating on the work at hand, the other person is pretty much watching the back, so to speak, you know, of the person that has to concentrate on their work. And, you know, what we use, very simple tool, is an umbrella. When we're out on the ledge and the birds are coming at us, we use an umbrella because it's nice and soft, and it's not meant to hit the birds or anything like that. It's just meant as a shield. So really anything can be used as a shield. Even a broom, if it's used properly, can be used to deflect the bird away mm-hmm. Safely.
And the people on the sidewalk, how vulnerable are they?
We're lucky in Columbus because our nest is so high up that really people on the sidewalk are not affected at all. We've only had questions from people that are working on rooftops of buildings. Now, if a juvenile falcon, you know, a fledgling, were to end up on the ground, you know, somebody could be at risk potentially then, but we've never had that happen in Columbus.
Good. 292-8513 is our phone number, 292-8513. We're speaking with Donna Daniels. She manages the Peregrine Nest in downtown Columbus for the Ohio Division of Wildlife. Sarah, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Donna, I just want to say how much I enjoy the Falcon Cam. I watch that daily.
Great.
And always checking in. And I watched the video of Swoop when he actually, or when she stepped off and slipped off the side of the building.
Swoop is one of the young peregrines.
Yes.
Correct? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that she was actually facing the building rather than facing outward. And I wondered if that would have made a difference in her survival if she had been facing forward versus, you know, falling facing the building.
Definitely. And you know, when the young falcons are old enough to fly, a lot of times we like it to see them leave the nest when they're ready. But sometimes it doesn't happen like that. They will fall off the ledge. A gust of wind will push them off the ledge. Sometimes they'll be tussling with each other, you know, and go off the ledge like that. But that's a good point. And I believe really actually what did happen is she probably did hit the side of the building, you know, at some point on her way down, because the eyewitness accounts from the ground indicated that she wasn't flapping, you know, when she was close to the ground. And that bird was old enough to fly. It had all the feathers it needed to fly. Flapping their wings is 100% instinct. So if it had gone off the building in maybe another way, you know, it would have flapped and hopefully wouldn't have turned out, you know, the way that it did. But you know, accidents do happen. There are a lot of dangers in the city, but there's a lot of benefits for these birds in the city as well. And, you know, unfortunately, some losses have to be expected. But that was really an unusual circumstance that I have not come across, you know, in my 15 years of working with the nest downtown.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
292-8513 if you'd like to join in our conversation, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. I mean, nature is just a messy thing sometimes. And
yet,
right. these things might happen on a cliff out in the middle of the woods, and no one ever see it, but you have a camera there.
Exactly, and that's the big difference here. You know, like I said, the urban nests do present dangers that the rural nests do not. But some of the benefits are that people all over the world literally are watching our Columbus falcons. And, you know, people downtown are well aware of the program. So if and when a bird goes down or there's an accident, I am notified very quickly, and you know, just even all the activity in the recent week and a half, I think we've had a total of, what, 4 incidents, including, you know, the fledge of Spirit also, and all the times when a bird ended up down close to the ground or on the ground, I was made aware of it in a very timely manner, so I was able to respond. And it's amazing how people downtown know and care and will call us.
Do downtown workers need more training to how to deal, or is the training that, or the word of mouth and the advice you give, is it getting out there?
I think, you know, with my experience with as quickly as people get in touch with me, I think everything is covered very well. You know, we've had some folks want to start like a Fledge Watch volunteer program, and we actually used to have that. But, you know, the program is so well known now that when something happens, I'm made aware of it pretty darn quickly. And, you know, I certainly don't want to, pardon me,
sure.
You know, discourage anybody from wanting to spend time downtown, because the more eyes, the better.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not going to, you know, organize anything official.
I see.
But, you know, people that are downtown working that are interested, you know, if they want to, you know, report to me, I really appreciate it.
And your blog, I assume, just details some of the things you talked about as far as wearing hard hats and maybe an umbrella and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Back to the phones. John, you're on the air. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised to hear that there's only one nesting pair downtown. I thought there were more than that. And it made me curious, because now that the female's been killed, what'll happen to the male? Will it find a new mate or move away? What's the future expectation?
Well, that's a good question. And believe it or not, there's a new female in town already as of yesterday. So, you know, a lot of people think that these birds mate for life, and that means a lot of different – that means different things to people than it does to wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is they keep the same mate from year to year until something happens, and then – once there's an opening, boy, there's another bird that moves in pretty quickly.
That does not take long.
No, and actually this is the second new female, because we had a new female last week that unfortunately, you know, didn't make it either. But, yeah, so this is the second bird within a week, and it is an adult bird that has leg bands, but we have not been able to confirm her identity yet.
Let me ask a stupid question. How did she know that the nest was available?
Well, basically there's a whole population of what we call floaters out there. Birds that are unmated. Exactly. Free agents. I like that. So they are just out there waiting in the wings, so to speak. And with the river there and mm-hmm. the tall buildings, it's excellent peregrine habitat. So, you know, I couldn't fathom how many peregrines might pass by in a summer's time. But without a resident female there to chase one out, then, hey, there's an opening and it'll be filled. So
interesting. The future of the program is – You'll continue to maintain this nest. Already somebody's moved in as a
mm-hmm.
new tenant. You think it's got a long-term future?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this nest has been in operation since the mid-90s. Columbus downtown area is excellent peregrine habitat. I would imagine we'll have nesting peregrines well into the future.
And the key is just to educating people
exactly.
on how humans and falcons can mm-hmm. could coexist. And
right.
Based on the number of people who watch that cam, mm-hmm. it's a pretty popular program.
It is, yes. And like I said, people from all over the world, literally. Even though there's other falcon cameras out there on other nests throughout the world, it seems like Columbus is everybody's favorite,
uh-huh.
and we appreciate that.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I'm not real sure.
Uh-huh.
I know our cameras, you know, we have the live streaming mm-hmm. as well as the refreshed mm-hmm. still images. We have a good high-quality mm-hmm. image on our camera. I don't know. If anybody has any ideas, let me know.
The bottom line is it's successful, and we learned something.
Exactly.
We learned about the floating falcon females who go up and down the river looking for empty nests.
Donna
Daniel with the State Division of Wildlife, thanks for joining us on All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820, NPR News.